The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the Adrenals and Gonads is presented by Dr. John Sutton.
The gonadal axis involves hypothalamic, pituitary, and gonads. Feedback mechanisms are important, as with many other disorders that relate to the pituitary. Without production of the end hormone, end hormone products, then the axis should respond to that lack of production. So the important issues here is whether or not the gonadotropins are elevated or not in response to what they should be elevated. And that would be, so elevated gonadotropins would be hypergonadotropic hypogonadism if the end product was low. So elevated gonadotropins and low gonadal hormones is primary end organ failure. Hypergonadotropic hypogonadism. Hypogonadotrophic would be inappropriately normal or low gonadotropins. So inappropriately normal means if you have a low estradiol level and the FSH is not elevated, then that means the pituitary is not responding appropriately. But it also is the same case if the estradiol level is low and the FSH is normal. So if the estradiol level is low, the FSH should not be normal. Problem is in the pituitary. You have a 24-year-old male. He presents with a female body habitus, lack of secondary sex characteristics, absent facial hair, infertility. Physical exam demonstrates 10 or 1 small testicles. So in this scenario, LH and FSH are elevated, testosterone is low, total, free, and bioavailable. The prolactin level is normal. So in these cases, you always want to know what the prolactin level is. In this case, it's normal. And normal thyroid function, because that can also affect prolactin and gonadotropins. And so in this scenario, the pituitary is responding appropriately to the lack of end organ hormone. This is hypergonadotropic hypo-HYPO-gonadism. In an adult male patient who presents like this with testicular failure, you always want to check a karyotype to determine whether or not this might represent Klinefelter syndrome. Hypergonadotrophic hypogonadism also would be germ cell arrest, surgery or chemotherapy to the end organ, mumps, alcohol, autoimmunity, intra-abdominal testicles would all result in primary end organ failure. If you have a 14-year-old male, though, that presents with breast development, gynecomastia, and a lack of secondary sexual characteristics, then you have to think of some other factors. So the LH and FSH are low and the testosterone is low, prolactin is normal, thyroid function is normal. That patient has hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, but at 14 it may be that he's just not hit puberty yet, so you have to think about that as well based on the age. So differential diagnosis would include delayed puberty, sort of late puberty that's not really particularly abnormal, and ultimately many of these patients don't have persistent hypogonadism. Kallmann syndrome, which involves deficiency in gonadotropin-releasing hormones, so the pituitary is not responding because there's not enough gonadotropin-releasing hormone. And these patients that have male hypogonadism, the key factor here is that they also lack a sense of smell, and then that's referred to as Kallmann syndrome, hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Hyperprolactinemia. So you want to know, as I said before, you want to know what the prolactin is, because if you have a really high prolactin, then that can mess everything else up. In particular, with hypogonadism, what it does is it suppresses gonadotropins, and you get low end organ testosterone, for example, from excessive prolactin, and you need to find out what the problem is with the prolactin and how to fix it. Infiltrative disease of the pituitary or hypothalamus, hemochromatosis, hypopituitarism in itself, which may be a random event, neoplasm, so this is why you have to image these people to make sure there's not a brain or pituitary neoplasm. Anorexia and excessive exercise can do it as well. So if you were to see a patient that had an Olympic athlete that had what appeared to be secondary hypogonadism, it could be intensive exercise as the reason for that issue. If fertility is the question, you would need to treat the patient with provocative agents to try to get the end organs to respond. And that would be most helpful in a patient with a pituitary problem in which the gonads are intact but aren't responding endogenously. In general, for restoring male hormone, though, without the question of fertility, we would give them back male hormone, typically in a gel form or potentially as an IM injection. Exogenous testosterone, though, suppresses the axis. So if this patient is desiring fertility, you may not want to add on testosterone quite as quickly. I have had patients that were able to conceive on testosterone, but they're basically jumping a big hurdle there because it really should shut down their own axis. Exogenous testosterone should make you make less of your own testosterone, and you need endogenous testosterone for fertility. Exogenous won't help fertility. So hyperprolactinemia, what do we see this? In the primary state, it's a pituitary neoplasm, the most common pituitary neoplasm that makes a substance. But you also see it in hypothyroidism. So a good scenario for where is the diagnosis would be a patient that was markedly hypothyroid that had a low libido, low testosterone, low gonadotropins, high prolactin and a high TSH. That patient, you need to start with the TSH, correcting that with thyroid hormone, and hopefully the other things will resolve. So I had a patient in this similar scenario a few years ago who had a normal prolactin in a man is somewhere about 15 or less in the fasting state. And he presented, actually, he didn't present to his physician, regular physician. He was having loss of vision. He was going blind. So as men, we have to go blind before we go to the doctor sometimes. But this guy finally went to the doctor, and the doctor says, you are not going blind for no good reason. You're going blind because you have a pituitary tumor that's making prolactin at a level of 2,000. So, and he had low libido, decreased peripheral vision, and it was all settled by giving him cabergoline to treat his tumor. Yeah, and in general, the general rule is if it's hyperprolactinemia, then medical therapy is almost all you need. Even when it's affecting vision, it can be treated that rapidly. If you have a 44-year-old male, on the other hand, that presents with breast tenderness, decreased sex drive, breast enlargement, genital exam is normal. So laboratory on this gentleman, normal estradiol, low testosterone, normal beta HCG. So HCG can cause gynecomastia, so you want to be careful there and measure that. Normal gonadotropins, high prolactin, normal thyroid function. So he has normal gonadotropins, but they really should be high because he has low testosterone. And in his case, normal thyroid function. So the problem is the prolactin is creating a problem, and you need to focus on the prolactin first before doing anything else. That is hypogonadotropic hypogonadism due to hyperprolactinemia. In this scenario, you would evaluate MRI of the brain and pituitary to look for a brain lesion or pituitary lesion. Treatment of the lesion in general would be with cabergoline or bromocriptine. Rarely these patients require pituitary surgery. Visual field testing is necessary if the tumor is very large, and particularly if you can see optic if you can see optic chiasm compression on the image. Differential diagnosis. Gynecomastia is common in the elderly, common in obese patients, common in puberty. Generally, we don't focus on it too much unless the patient presents to you and says, I'm having a problem with breast development, which is very difficult for men to admit. High estradiol may represent testicular or adrenal neoplasm. High HCG could suggest a testicular or pulmonary neoplasm. You want to be careful with HCG historically. In patients that had an elevated HCG, this is considered a tumor marker, and there have been historically patients where the doctor was not treating a known measurable disease, but they were treating the tumor marker. So you have to be careful with this like you do other tumor markers. You have to look for the actual neoplasm rather than jump to treat that the tumor marker. Sometimes the problem is, in other words, sometimes the problem is the assay, not that the patient has something. So you have to be very careful how you use it. Hypothyroidism, of course, can cause hyperprolactinemia. So you want to know that the patient's euthyroid and not hyperprolactinemic before you take the next step. A 16-year-old female presents with a lack of secondary sexual characteristics, no periods, never had a period known as primary amenorrhea. This patient has low LH and FSH and low estradiol, so hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism. These patients with hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism could have a pituitary tumor, Kallmann syndrome, including anosmia, anorexia nervosa, excessive exercise. So in addition to this, you have a patient that presents with short stature, prepubertal genital examination. These patients have primary amenorrhea with no prior history of menses because secondary amenorrhea refers to absent periods after you've had at least one, after menarche. In this scenario, you have hypergonadotrophic hypogonadism with known as Turner syndrome based on physical presentation. In hypergonadotrophic hypogonadism, this is the classic ovarian failure at menopause, a surgical removal of the ovaries, Turner syndrome 45XO, all of those have elevated gonadotropins, hypergonadotropic hypogonadism, end organ failure, and the pituitary is responding appropriately. Secondary amenorrhea are patients that start to have periods and then stop for some reason. Those include patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome, in which there's adequate estrogen, excess androgen, uterine defects, and trauma, pregnancy, of course, profound stress, systemic illness. I like to tell patients when we're talking about this that there are times in which a lady might not have a period, and one of those main times is when she's in the ICU. You ask your ICU nurses, they rarely have to use pads because the body shuts down this process even when they're in their childbearing years. This is a patient with facial hirsutism. This is another scenario, particularly in this age group, in which this particular lady was in Carson City Hospital, and I was called onto the case, and Many times someone had tried to decide what was happening. This is a good case scenario because the lady herself wasn't particularly concerned about it, and that makes it less significant. She had had it for years. That made it less significant. But what I would routinely do is check DHEAS and total testosterone, as well as typically free testosterone as well. And if the DHEAS is greater than 2 times normal, consider the possibility there may be a neoplasm of the adrenal glands. And the typical cutoff for excessive for neoplastic disease in the ovaries from testosterone would be greater than 200. The assays are getting better, and it may go all the way down to 150. Most of the patients that you have with mild hirsutism won't have abnormal levels at all. You should consider congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Cushing syndrome, virilizing tumors, PCO. Now we're going to go on to disease of the adrenals. The zona glomerulosa is where you get mineral corticoids. Aldosterone is the primary one of concern for you. Angiotensin 2 and renin regulation by sympathetic tone is important in this process. An increase in aldosterone leads to salt and water retention. An increase in angiotensin 2 leads to vasoconstriction. This is a little cartoon of that. Zona fasciculata and reticularis. Glucocorticoids and cortisol are made, glucocorticoids in the form of cortisol are made here. Also, androgens come from this area of the adrenal glands. And these things are regulated in some part by ACTH. The steroid production pathway or steroidogenesis pathway starts with the basic substrate of cholesterol. The body uses LDL receptors to pull cholesterol out of the serum and make the steroids from various organs in the body. The precursors to this after cholesterol are formed as DHEAS and 17-hydroxyprogesterone, and the end products are cortisol, estradiol, aldosterone. This is the general format of steroidogenesis pathway. So a patient presents to your office or to the ER who is a 20-year-old female with weight loss, easily tanning, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, weakness, and dizzy, and blood pressure is low, and the patient is confused. This is a patient of mine that I previously had in my practice in Carson City, and she presented already with this diagnosis. She kind of has a funny-looking tan. She has irregular tanning on her hands. This picture here in the inset is a picture of a different patient with vitiligo. But if you have a patient with vitiligo and you're seeing them for considering endocrine disorders, vitiligo is an autoimmune skin disorder that might appear in patients that would otherwise have autoimmune disease. So this young lady would have presented with hyponatremia, HYPO, hyperkalemia, potentially hypoglycemia, elevated BUN creatinine from dehydration. That would be primary adrenal insufficiency. In routine, you can do a screening test in an early AM. I usually say fasting 8 AM cortisol and ACTH. But the test of choice would really be a cortisone stimulation test, which is synthetic ACTH. Standardly given IM or IV in a dose of 250 micrograms. You get a baseline cortisol, 30-minute and 60-minute cortisol values. You could potentially also do aldosterone values in this test, but routinely we just do cortisol levels. You're looking for any of the cortisol values to be greater than 18 to 20. The etiology of primary adrenal insufficiency is about 80% is autoimmune or idiopathic, 20% tuberculosis, and other minor reasons for adrenal insufficiency. autoimmune etiology, also known as Addison disease. A lot of patients get labeled Addison that haven't been even clearly proven, but basically you're saying adrenal insufficiency from primary deficiency of steroid from the adrenal gland. It could be associated with other autoimmune conditions, and particularly Hashimoto thyroiditis. So a similar patient presents to you with similar symptoms as that index patient, low to no normal blood pressure, fatigue, weakness, no change in skin color, COPD. So in this scenario, the sodium is also low, but the potassium is normal. If the potassium is normal in a patient that you're considering adrenal insufficiency, that suggests that aldosterone is intact and suggests that it is not primary adrenal insufficiency. Low ACTH are inappropriately normal. So you have a low cortisol and the ACTH does not respond. That is a pituitary problem. So in this scenario, this patient actually presents with a long-term steroid use history when the history is taken. She had a change in pharmacy and somehow the prednisone did not get renewed. And so she presents with a pneumonia when she comes into crisis, and basically she doesn't have the prednisone to protect her, and she develops results in secondary adrenal insufficiency. Now, most of these patients are less likely to have an adrenal crisis than primary adrenal patients that don't have their steroids, but it can happen. Steroid-dependent tumor, infection, radiation, surgery, trauma involving the hypothalamus or pituitary could also be etiologies. Physical findings in adrenal insufficiency could include generalized abdominal tenderness, fever because maybe the crisis is precipitated by an infection, postural hypotension. You want to look for a precipitating infection. A careful consideration for surgical abdomen. This is something that the surgeons are not thinking about. So if you have one of these patients, you have to put your yourself in that case to protect the patient. And we try when we have a known case to tell patients this. And in most cases, I try to tell patients this even when I'm in the midst of workup, because invariably some of them are preparing for the next surgery or whatever and could be a crisis situation if they have adrenal insufficiency. So that generalized abdominal tenderness could be perceived by a surgeon as a surgical candidate, and yet the problem is really tenderness from adrenal insufficiency. The electrolyte imbalance is typically hypo-HYPO-natremia, but hyper-HYPER-kalemia is also found in, of course, in primary adrenal insufficiency. Hypotension or medical crisis might bring them to view, and hyponatremia without hyperkalemia generally represents the secondary etiology, and they're less likely to have a crisis because aldosterone can kick in the time of crisis. 85 to 90% of these patients will have hypo-HYPO-natremia. Mineralocorticoid deficiency results in the sodium loss and volume depletion, increased vasopressin secretion due to the loss of cortisol. Hyperkalemia in 60 to 65% of patients. Rarely, you can also have hypercalcemia. Imaging, if you decide to image them, you could image a patient with primary adrenal insufficiency. You might see a problem. You might think you're looking for a tumor, but the tumor really has to encompass both entire adrenal glands for that to result in adrenal insufficiency. I have seen that a couple of times in over 20 years in practice, but not frequently. Most of the time in Addison, you're going to see a little small adrenal glands. MRI of the brain is necessary and pituitary to look for secondary adrenal insufficiency causes unless the cause is clear. So if you have you don't really need to do a pituitary MRI if you have a patient that there's clearly an issue with steroid dependence. At the diagnosis in crisis, we use IV hydrocortisone and later titrate downward to a total daily dose of 25 milligrams per day, preferably hydrocortisone. Saline and glucose are added to the mix. You need to do supportive care. And if they have primary adrenal insufficiency, you have to add Florinef to correct the entire problem. In regards to long-term treatment of steroids, if the steroids in any dose are given over less than 30 days, then you don't really need to wean those off to protect the adrenal glands. The adrenal glands are pretty safe, even in high doses, over a less than four-week period. I did have a patient recently who was on very high doses of steroids for ITP, she was on huge doses of dexamethasone. The hematologist actually gave her huge doses of dexamethasone, 10 4-milligram tablets initially over a few days, then she would go off for a few days, then she would go back on week after week after week. And when I tested her adrenal axis, because someone was afraid that was a problem for her coming off of those, she had an intact adrenal axis, even though she was on these huge doses of dexamethasone. So don't assume that a patient that's on huge doses is automatically going to be adrenally insufficient. Some of them are okay. And in the literature, where that is focused is the fact that every patient isn't fully compliant. So some patients that you think are taking their prednisone every day are not, and they've actually saved their own adrenal glands because of it. So don't make an assumption that you won't be able to get someone off of steroids, because sometimes the axis is still intact. Crisis intervention should be explained to the patient. If they have surgery or acute illness, you need to give them instructions. Generally, I ask them to call. If they wind up in a hospital where there is no endocrinologist, I ask them to ask, if they otherwise won't contact me, I ask them to give more steroids around the time of surgery or acute illness, particularly if there's electrolyte imbalance or hypoHYPO tension. You can do this in short illness. If the patient is not feeling well, sometimes we'll ask that allow them to double dose even at home when they're under short illness. All of the while, you're observing for blood pressure and electrolyte balance. Next patient is a patient that's gaining weight, has hirsutism, diabetes, osteoporosis, centripetal obesity, stria. This is a patient actually that had stria from exogenous steroids, suburban Detroit. She also had chipmunk facies from the steroids, and she had a little bit of hirsutism. This would be Cushing syndrome. Cushing syndrome is excessive steroid, whether it's given exogenously or whether it's being endogenously produced, and it's your job to figure out which one is which. In this case, we were concerned because she was off the steroid and she was still exhibiting signs of Cushing, and we thought maybe she had endogenous Cushing syndrome, but she did not. The test that you can perform would be a 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test. Generally, suppressing to 3 to 5 is acceptable. The literature actually says less than 2 might be more of an absolute. 24-hour urine-free cortisol is also a way to do this. You do need to do 24-hour urine-free cortisol when the patient is on something that's affecting cortisol-binding globulin, like estrogen. So if they have high cortisol-binding globulin from estrogen administration, then you can't use serum cortisol. And I have had those consults as well, where the patient was on hormone replacement therapy or birth control and came to me for a high cortisol, and the problem was just the estrogen that they were on. In that scenario, you would need to do a 24-hour urine-free cortisol to try to separate out the pieces. You also only want to run cortisol levels on a patient who you think really has it. So I got a case this year who the primary doctor decided that his headaches might be caused by Cushing syndrome. I'm not sure if he came up with that, or the primary doctor came up with that, but he came to me thinking he had Cushing's syndrome, and he was this skinny mini guy who from the Lake Tahoe area who didn't have any, there was no signal to suggest that he had Cushing, and it took us several weeks to a few months to sort it out for him, to assure him that he didn't have it, even though he had, the presentation was clearly not that of Cushing's syndrome. Pregnancy stria are the stretch marks from pregnancy that generally over time kind of become light and are not particularly wide. And the differential diagnosis for Cushing's syndrome would be Cushing disease, which is when you have ACTH-dependent Cushing syndrome involving a pituitary lesion, and that makes it Cushing disease. ACTH independent versus dependent is important to try to determine. Exogenous steroids cause Cushing's syndrome, adrenal adenoma or hyperplasia, and also, of course, ectopic steroid, ectopic production of ACTH, for example. This is a patient of mine that had Cushing's syndrome from exogenous steroids for a brain tumor. He had stria. Again, differential diagnosis, Cushing disease, Cushing disease and ectopic production of ACTH would be ACTH dependent. Adrenal disease would be ACTH independent, where ACTH is not part of the mix. You try to sort this out using dexamethasone suppression testing. You want to try to sort this out before imaging if possible. If you're going to imaging, you would do MRI of the pituitary for Cushing disease. Cushing syndrome, you would look at the adrenal glands, and ectopic, try to localize the source otherwise with other imaging. Again, you don't start by doing all these images. You start by doing the laboratory workup. Adrenal carcinoma is typically metastatic at diagnosis, presents with weight loss, rapid onset of the condition, typical excessive activity of the steroidogenesis pathway, and does not typically involve adrenal insufficiency. 35-year-old female presents with hyper-HRPER tension, hypokalemia, thin, looks like a patient that shouldn't have a problem with blood pressure. You would consider the possibility of hyperaldosteronism. Do the biochemical workup first. Don't go straight to the image. Adrenal neoplasm, extremely common. You would expect to see low renin, high aldosterone in primary adrenal, primary hyperaldosteronism. High renin, high aldosterone would be secondary hyperaldosteronism. Elevated 24-hour urine aldosterone on a high-sodium diet and off of diuretics. I do also use a test called a saline suppression test. If you give a large amount of IV saline, the aldosterone should be suppressed with the saline administration. You can have adrenal adenoma, which generally you need to prove by adrenal venous sampling, or idiopathic hyperaldosteronism, which involves both adrenal glands. You'd like to hone down on adrenal adenoma, because if you remove that and that's the problem, then you can correct their hypertension, or mostly correct their hypertension. Localization testing. I did have a patient this last year, that had clearly primary hyperaldo, and when I did send him to a tertiary center because I thought maybe he needed adrenal venous sampling, and they decided that since the one adrenal gland had a lesion and the other clearly had no lesion, that they did not do adrenal venous sampling. But in general, adrenal venous sampling is the gold standard, particularly because adrenal neoplasm is so common. Okay, talked about that. Patient, 40-year-old patient presents with hypertension, normal electrolytes, thin as in 40-year-old maybe shouldn't have hypertension, headache, palpitations. You want to consider the possibility of pheochromocytoma. Check 24-hour urine for fractionated catecholamines, fractionated metanephrines, and VMA. Generally try to test them off meds if possible. Some endocrinologists recommend doing serum testing. What you'll see in the literature on serum testing, which I think is reasonable, is that something that most of us can't do reasonably, which is the patient should be in a supine position for about 30 minutes in a quiet room with an indwelling cannula when they get their blood drawn. And technically, the technician is supposed to sort of sneak in and not disturb the patient, try to draw the blood so that the catecholamines don't go up. It's kind of complicated. The most important thing about all of that is these values need to be several times normal, not just a little bit above normal. So when you have urinary metanephrines that are 10 points above normal, then that's not a pheo. And when you have serum the same way, it's not a pheo. You want to localize it by MRI or CT. Historically, the tracer of choice, the nuclear test of choice would be an MIBG scan. Meta, logo, benzyl, guanidine, nuclear scan. That's why you call it MIBG. Tracer concentration concentrates in catecholamines. Alpha blockers are preferred first. Preferably phenoxybenzamine, which is an absolute alpha blocker for the treatment and preparation for surgery. You don't want to start with beta blockers. If you have a patient with severe hypertension that you're considering, might possibly represent a pheo, you can put them into a pheo crisis by adding a beta blocker. You also want to avoid biopsy of a lesion that has not been proven not to be a pheo. So you don't want to stick a needle in a pheo. You might cause a pheo crisis. This is a patient of mine that had a large pheo. Their feet towards the screen, which means it's a right adrenal tumor. It should be a thin wisp, like a little wishbone, and this was a huge tumor. This was intraoperatively, and this was in the bucket. It was a 10 centimeter pheo. There he is before, and there it is after the pheo has been removed. This is a patient, the radiologist has carefully circled the lesion there that's sort of like a little drumstick at the end of the adrenal gland. And this was, could have been considered an incidental adrenal adenoma if the test was not done for this reason and this patient had breast cancer. The likelihood of a lesion in the adrenal gland being breast cancer met is very likely. And so you have to be very careful to try to sort that out. In other words, this is not considered an incidental adenoma when you're looking for evidence of metastatic breast cancer. Incidental adrenal adenomas are typically benign, and you need to avoid imaging to look for these unless you have a clear biochemical evidence.